Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Listeners do support the Peter B. Collins Show, and I'm much obliged. Today we'll single out Marianne Crawford of Seattle, a longtime supporter of the Peter B. Collins Show. You can help, too. Just go to my website at peterbcollins.com. Our voluntary subscriptions start as low as $5 a month. You ever ask yourself what happens when you die? Explorations of death, dying, and the hereafter have been underway as long as mankind has been on the earth. Bishop John Shelby Spong joins me this portion of the Peter B. Collins Show. He's a prolific writer, tens of books out there. They sent me a list of his top five bestsellers just to try to put perspective on it. And his newest, which he pledges is his last, is called Eternal Life, A New Vision, subtitled Beyond Religion, Beyond Theism, Beyond Heaven and Hell. Bishop John Shelby Spong, welcome to the Peter B. Collins Show.
Thanks, sir. Good to be with you.
Well, it's nice to talk with you, and your book is very open and honest. You're approaching the age of 80, and you seem to be very much at peace with the ultimate outcome of your life.
Well, I think I am. I don't think I require anything more at the end of my life. I've lived long and well and happily and with a deep sense of fulfillment. I don't think that this life is without value, even if nothing accompanies it at the end. Mm-hmm. But I've also spent a great deal of time pursuing at least the possibility that there's something beyond this world, and I've pursued it primarily through scientific data and not through religious data, and that is probably what makes this book a little bit unusual.
Now, do you happen to know, has your death panel met yet and made a determination about your fitness to continue on the planet?
Well, I've certainly made an agreement with my beloved wife that when I can't see or appreciate her smile or the touch of her hand, I don't want to be around. And I think it's really rather amazing that we live in the age we live in, where modern medicine and modern technology has expanded life enormously, for which I'm really grateful. But I think we've gotten to the place where instead of expanding life in many instances, all we're doing is postponing death, and I think that's really not a good thing to be doing.
And Bishop Spong, I'm in my late 50s. My mother is turning 86 next week, and my partner's mother and aunts are in their 80s. And I have to say that it's a mixed bag. It really depends on the individual and how their bodies and minds survive the last portion of the trip.
Absolutely.
But I have to tell you about my Aunt Marie, who lived to the ripe old age of 97. And starting at about age 90, I'd get phone calls from her saying, Peter, you don't want to live this long. It's boring. She said, all my friends and loved ones are gone, and I'm here in a nursing home with people I don't know.
Yeah.
And she had minor infirmities, was, you know, very aware and conscious right up until the end. And so how do you advise people in terms of this mixed blessing? Because certainly to be able to see your great-grandchildren is a wonderful thing. But to be a burden on those succeeding generations is also something that elderly people feel.
I just have the strong feeling that as long as life has meaning, as long as you're in living relationships that are affirming, that we celebrate every moment we've got. I think when you get to the place where you're in pain all the time and you don't have any significant relationships because you've outlived them all, I just think I'm ready to die at that point. And I think I'd die with an affirmation of life. There's nothing suicidal about that, in my opinion, because life is really precious, and it's mysterious and wondrous, and I really want to scale its heights and plumb its depths. But I do think that we have biological clocks within us, and that biological clock keeps running. And when it gets to the place where there's no great meaning left, then I have a living will. My wife has power to turn off whatever equipment might be there, and I talk with every doctor I have about the fact that I think it's my legal and moral right to be assisted in the end of my life if that's my decision. I don't want anybody else to make that decision for me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'd trust my wife to make that decision, but you know, I don't want doctors or hospitals or insurance companies or the government or anybody else to make that decision, but I do want that decision to be my own, and I want it to be looked upon as a moral choice and a legal right.
And Reverend Mr. Spong, why is it that it's Christian fundamentalists who believe that they can impose their views and values on others, and particularly in these critical end-of-life decisions? You know, we saw that the Republicans who got elected with, you know, a large segment of votes from the Christian community pandered to that group on both abortion issues and end-of-life issues.
And homosexuality. They bashed homosexuals, too, for good measure.
Indeed. But talk about how the Terri Schiavo case affected you, because it turned my stomach.
Well, it turned mine, too, and I think it was the end of the Bush administration. You look at the people who engineered that. They're all in private life today. Tom DeLay is in Dancing with the Stars. Bill Frist is living in retirement in Tennessee, and George Bush is cutting brush down in Crawford, Texas. You know, I think that that was the moment when the American people woke up and said, I don't want anybody imposing their religious standards upon this pluralistic society. It was a very frightening kind of thing. But that's the nature of religion, Peter. That's why we fight religious wars. That's why we burn heretics at the stake. That's why we go on crusades. That's why we bomb the World Trade Center in the name of the true God. There's something about religion that's designed to make people feel secure. And you don't feel secure unless you believe your religion is ultimately true. And if you believe it's ultimately true, you think you have some obligation to impose it on everybody. And that's the nature. I think we've got to get out of that insecurity game that we're playing. I think God is real, and I think God can be approached in a multiplicity of ways, and I think it's human arrogance above anything else that will say, the way I understand God is the only way God can be understood. The way I approach God is the only way God can be approached. That's nothing except taking your own images and making ultimate idols out of them. And the biblical story is right strong against idolatry.
And why is it that people feel that they have a kind of God-given right or a righteousness derived from God to impose their standards? They believe their standards are higher. They believe that they are responding to a higher moral calling.
Yep.
At the same time, many of these people, and I don't want to overgeneralize, but are riddled with inconsistencies. You know, they don't support abortion rights. They don't support an individual's right to choose the time and manner of their passing. Yet they believe in capital punishment, and they either turn a blind eye or they're cheerleaders for wars of mass destruction.
Well, don't ever expect organized religion to be appropriate in every situation. That's not the way it operates. You need to understand, and it took me years. I grew up in an evangelical fundamentalist tradition in the Bible Belt of the South. It took me a long time to work through some of the things that system had done to me. But you need to understand that the primary purpose of religion in the lives of most people is to make them secure. It's not to seek the truth. They really don't want to be bothered with the truth. They want security. Otherwise, you wouldn't do absurd things like claim your pope is infallible or your Bible is inerrant, or there is such a thing as one true church, or you somehow control the pathway to God and nobody can come to God except through your pathway, those are all the manifestations of hysterically insecure people struggling to find a security blanket in which they can wrap themselves. I don't think the Christian faith, as I understand it, will ever give me security. I think what it gives me is the courage to live with integrity in a radically insecure world as a radically insecure human being. And I think we grasp that as our destiny.
Well, that's a very powerful statement that you made there, and it reflects a lot about me and I'm sure other people. I was raised a Catholic, a Jesuit education. I consider myself a small C Christian and a recovering Catholic. And I don't support the earthly church. And let me just take a moment to tell you, when I visited the Vatican, and I've been there four or five times in my life, I have such mixed feelings. Because on the one hand, I really do feel a kind of grandeur and a sense of celebration of something greater than human. And on the other hand, I see a fraternity that has controlled some of the world's most precious real estate and valued it over the lives of the people they are supposed to be serving.
Yeah.
And it just produces these conflicts. And when the hierarchy attempts to impose what I think are either short-sighted or wrong-headed values on people, it really does come down to their search for security.
Absolutely.
And that desire to have answered the unanswerable question. Now,
that's correct.
Bishop Spong, you say that after all of your study, and it appears you have read virtually everything that's ever been written about death and dying, that you come to a conclusion that your own belief is that there is something after this mortal period that we spend on Earth. Explain.
Well, I see intimations of immortality in the midst of life. What I did was to study life. I don't know how anybody can study life after death. Who's going to investigate it? Where do you go to investigate it? Who do you interview? Who's ever been there to come back? There's an absolute dearth of material. So when somebody tells you what life after death is like, then I think you know that they're a charlatan, that you just can't go on with that. The real issue is there something about life in its self-conscious human form that transcends the limits of time and space and that communes with eternity? I think there is. I think we have all sorts of things that help us to make that decision. But all I can do is assert that that's what my conviction is. I can't tell you who God is or what God is. I can only tell you how I believe I have experienced God, and I may be delusional. So I can tell you what I believe life leads me to state about life after death, but I can give you no pictures. And if people look at this book expecting word pictures, they're going to be misled. That's why I insisted with my publisher, HarperCollins, and it was a really acrimonious debate, I must say, that this book not just be called Eternal Life. That's what they wanted to call it. I wanted to call it, I put all the qualifiers in there. A new vision implies that the old vision isn't working anymore. Beyond religion implies that you've got to get beyond the language and the security system of human religion. Beyond theism means you've got to get beyond the definition of God as a supernatural being external to the world who comes to our rescue from time to time. And beyond heaven and hell, and I really wanted that to say reward and punishment, but my publisher insisted on heaven and hell because they said people would understand that so much better. I wanted them to know that you've got to get beyond that parent in the sky judge image of God before whom quivering sinners have to stand and the record book is read out and they're assigned their due, either punishment or reward, either heaven or hell. I think that's immature, childlike religion, and I think it's more distorting of God and more distorting of human life than it is anything else. To go back to your thing about the power images in the Vatican, and they can be replicated in almost every church. But I think what you need to know is that if you look at the Christian story in its biblical form, that the Christian church was always referred to in tiny minority images. You are to be the salt in the soup. You are to be the leaven in the loaf. You are to be the light in the darkness. And somewhere along the way, we transformed Christianity into Christendom and then began to act as if we had power to make kings and to depose kings and lead crusades and condemn people to hell. And then we worked out all the doctrines and dogmas and then said, of course, you have to believe these or there's no hope for you. It's all a power equation, And I think religion has distorted Christianity rather badly.
Well, and what you're just describing there reminds me, I once was a tourist on the island of Corsica, and a local professor took us around to three or four of the local churches. And he described them, first we went to a Franciscan church, and it was very bare bones, and it had posters instead of original art. And then we went to a Dominican church, where things were a little more upscale. The pews were finished wood, and there was gold on the altar and some gold relief in the art in the building. And then we went to a Jesuit chapel, which was kind of the top of the line. And as he described this to us, it kind of struck me as that the Vatican had a business plan and that they populated new areas the way, hotel chains popped up on the interstate highways when we built them here in this country.
Yeah.
And that they were serving different segments of a kind of consumer society with kind of different frames, but the central message was the same. It was a control system, not one that was designed to inspire people around Christ's message of love, but that was designed to rein them in around a message of guilt and sin and darkness.
There's no doubt that that's been a major player. I would say, however, that in many parts of the world, the only sense of beauty that people have is what they find in their religious symbols. And so there's even a desire among the poorer people of the world to have a place that is beautiful, that is transcendent, that sort of lifts up their whole corporate life. And I think the church has filled that role for a number of people. Now, of course, it gets excessive. When Christianity got institutionalized, it began to act like every other institution. You're not old enough to remember Charlie Wilson, who was the Secretary of Defense in the Eisenhower administration, who said, "What's good for General Motors is good for America."
Mm-hmm.
Glad he didn't say that today. We'd all be bankrupt. But I think institutions always act in the manner that will help to preserve the institution. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was a Lutheran pastor in World War II, who was executed by the Nazis because he was engaged in a plot to assassinate Hitler. But he wrote a number of things before he died, and they were later saved and published, called Letters and Papers from Prison. And in one of them, he said, just as Christianity had to go beyond the boundaries of Judaism in the first century in order to become a worldwide faith, so in our generation, Christianity's got to break the boundaries of religion to become something that will continue to live. And he talked about religionless Christianity. Now, most people think that's an oxymoron. But I think that that's a really powerful insight, and I think if we can separate the Christian message, which I believe is life-affirming, from the religious message, which is so much designed to make us feel inadequate and inferior. Mm-hmm. We talk about being born in sin and being miserable offenders and not worthy to gather up the crumbs under God's table, and we have to placate or flatter God so that God will do for us what we want and be our rescuer. I think the story of Jesus ought to be told in terms of an experience of love in a human form that empowers us to be so deeply and fully human that we can live fully and love wastefully and be all that we can be. And the job of the church is not to make people religious. The job of the church is to free people to be human. And that's a very different message. But that's the one I think we've got to recover.
We're talking with Bishop John Shelby Spong here on the Peter B. Collins Show. And Bishop, if you'll indulge me, I have a song here I'd like you to react to. This was written by Curtis Mayfield. He was a member of the Impressions in the late 50s, early 60s, and a real anchor of the music scene in Chicago. And this is a song he wrote in kind of a protest phase of his life in the late 1960s.
And if people would just get read the Bible and read the Book of Revelations, they would really turn around and straighten up. This is all we need to do, is just get the good book and read it, put it to everyday life.
Sisters! Niggas! Whiteys! Jews! Crackers! Don't worry. If there's hell below, we're all gonna go!
Ah!
Song's a little edgy, but Curtis Mayfield avers if there's a hell below, we're all going to go. What are your thoughts about the devil, Lucifer, Hades, and that version of the afterlife?
Well, I don't think any of that exists. I think all that's mythology, again, used in the name of institutional control. I do think we need to face the fact that there is, about the human animal, a radical self-centeredness that's bent on making survival the highest value of that life. I think that's the baggage of evolution. I don't believe we would have come through the 3.8 billion years of evolutionary history from single cells to self-conscious people had we not had this drive to survive, which becomes self-conscious. I believe it's in all of nature, but it becomes self-conscious in human life. And so we organize our lives around that. And immediately, when you make your desire to survive the most important virtue and value of your life, you relate to everything out of your self-centeredness. And I think we hurt and kill people. That's why we're afraid of people. That's why we're xenophobic. That's why we're prejudiced. That's why we play one-upmanship games. That's why we go to war. I think you've got to take seriously the fact that human beings are capable of enormous evil. Now, you don't cure evil by telling people how evil they are. You cure evil or that self-centeredness by giving them such a deep sense of what it means to be alive and to love and to be that they can transcend survival and give themselves away. And that's what the Jesus story seems to me to be all about.
But isn't the promise of an afterlife and heaven and all of those things the ultimate expression of human narcissism?
I think it is if you look at it that way. But that's why I want to get rid of reward and punishment or heaven and hell. Because if I live my life motivated primarily by the desire to gain a reward or to escape a punishment, I have not escaped this self-centered quality that places me above everybody else. It's ultimately narcissistic.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, Peter, we have experiences in this world, like falling in love. That's an easy one for me because I simply adore my wife. But when you fall in love, you get outside your desire to survive. You care more for your beloved than you care for yourself. You'd be willing to die for your beloved. And I think that's the best foretaste we have of what it means to be fully human. And the job of the Christian church is not to make you religious, it's to empower you to become so fully human that you're not motivated by your self-centered survival needs. And now that's really... That's idealistic to think about. But I believe that evolution, that we have survived, we are now the top of the hill in the evolutionary struggle. But if we don't do something about increasing our sense of humanity, we'll commit genocide because we're turning this hostility upon ourselves. We fight tribal wars. We encourage prejudices. And the religious institutions are the ones that encourage the most prejudice.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in the Bible Belt. Please recognize and help me understand how the part of the nation that goes to church most often, reads the Bible most regularly, is most overtly religious, is also the part of the nation that enslaved human beings, that resisted segregation with all of their might, and that today is probably the most homophobic part of the United States. Homophobia almost doesn't exist in the secular society, but still alive and well in the religious communities. And all of that, I think, tells us something about what's happened to religion.
And what does it tell us? Because I don't know, I reached this point where I believe that, coming back to your points about security, that these people, and I hesitate even to use the language here because I don't want to lump everybody together into one generalized category, but we do see the expressions of it in broad ways, and it seems that they are so determined to get brownie points in their scheme to get to heaven or get rewards in the afterlife,
yep,
that they're willing to trample their fellow human beings. And, you know, I'm just thinking right now, I get emails every week from the Christian Coalition trying to block passage of health care reform in this,
yep,
country.
Yep.
Now, what on earth would Christ do to try to stop people from getting the health care that they need and deserve and figuring out a way to pay for it?
Well, I couldn't agree more, and I have found the health care debate to be frightening and debilitating, and lets me know the levels of hostility that are present in this country, where people, I think, will do anything and say anything, whether it's true or not, in order to accomplish their political goals. But let me go back again. I really don't want my Jesus to get mixed up with so much of what is religion today. If you read the fourth gospel, and that's the last gospel to be written, some 70 years after the life of Jesus was complete, they interpret Jesus' life as saying, I have come that you might have life and have it abundantly. Now, how does the institution, the church, act out that? What do we do to help people have abundant life? Well, you certainly don't keep 40 million people without health insurance. You don't keep people living below the level of poverty in the richest nation in the world. But, you know, somehow those have become political issues, and those are communist or socialist or whatever. It's as if what life after death did, what the promise of life after death did, was to project fairness into an afterlife so you don't have to deal with fairness in this life. Indeed, it wasn't until life after death, as we traditionally understand it, began to fade in people's convictions that you began to have political movements that were aimed at making fair the only world we were absolutely sure of. And of course it was called communist, but look, it's in both Europe and America. We had labor parties, socialist parties, communist parties, Christian socialist parties all over the continent. In America, you had the square deal of Teddy Roosevelt, the new deal of Franklin Roosevelt, the fair deal of Harry Truman, the great society of Lyndon Johnson, where we really made an effort to bring about fairness. Now, it petered out. We didn't accomplish it. So if you don't have fairness in life after death, and if you can't create it politically, what do you do? Well, I think beginning with the Reagan and Thatcher administrations, we decided that the only thing to do is that everybody gets theirs. And I think we ushered in the politics of greed. And I think the politics of greed is what killed this nation in October of last year when the whole economy began to free fall. And we're struggling now to get out from under that. And greed is still an apparent reality. But greed says to me that you have no ultimate value, and so you've got to sort of squirrel up everything you can get to make this life as good as possible, and you really don't care about anybody else because it's every man or every woman for himself or herself. Now, that's what I think happens when you take a realistic understanding of God as the life force calling people to live and the power of love enabling people to love and what Paul Tillich called the ground of being that calls us to have the courage to be ourselves and to give the gifts of life, love, and being to everybody in the world. I don't know how you're going to do it if we can't do it politically, and it doesn't look like the Christian church is in a position where it can do it at all because it doesn't even understand the battle. It's too busy telling people how wretched, miserable, and sinful they are.
And how much of that is the influence of the end times and the best-selling Tim LaHaye series? I mean, there are a lot of people who seem captivated by that. I don't know to what degree they live their lives based on it.
Well, we have a lot of people who respond to fear and the Tim LaHaye stuff. But we had that in the 19th, 18th century. We had something called the Great Awakening in this country, a great spiritual revival led by a Massachusetts preacher named Jonathan Edwards who went around delivering his famous sermon, Sinners in the Hand of an Angry God. And in that sermon, he pictured God holding sinful people by the singed hairs of their head over the fiery pits of hell to elicit conversions. Well, if that's a realistic picture, you can get converted pretty quickly. And so there's a great awakening in this country. We've always been manipulating human beings with religious symbols. That's from the dawn of time. That's why I think we've got to get beyond religion and beyond the theistic definition of God, which I mean the powerful supernatural figure before whom we quake in fear, who controls us with guilt and the threat of punishment. And beyond that childlike thing, I don't know any parent that would raise their children knowingly by saying, if you're a good kid, we'll give you a reward, and if you're a bad kid, we'll give you some pain, and expect that to create a happy and whole adult. And a part of the job of the parent is to help their child grow into a new kind of humanity, a new kind of maturity. I think the church ought to look at that in the same way.
I've got another song here, Bishop Spong. This is from Jackson Browne, who lost a woman who was very important to him, I believe the mother of his child or children, and he wrote a song for her called For a Dancer.
I don't know what happens when people die. I can't seem to grasp it as hard as I try. It's like a song I can hear playing right in my ear that I can't sing.
I can't help listening. And I can't help feeling stupid standing round. Crying is the easier down. Cause I know that you'd rather we were dancing. Dancing our sorrow away.
Now he expresses for me what is a truth, and that is, I don't know what happens when we die. And I'm not disinterested, yet at the same time, I do not focus my life on trying to jockey for position in the afterlife.
I don't think you should, and I don't think anybody knows what happens after you die. When I began to study this subject, and it's fascinated me for a long time, I started this book 3 times, but that's because I quit it on 2 occasions over 25 years. But what I began to look at is if you go not into religion, you go into life. One of the things we've learned about life is that, first of all, life reaches self-consciousness in human beings so that we are able to commune with whatever is beyond life. We begin to ask questions about whether life has meaning. I don't know of a dog or a cat that asks whether or not life has meaning. We've discovered DNA. We now know that DNA links all life. We're kin to the great apes, but we're also kin to the cabbages. We're kin to the plankton of the sea. You'll read Carl Jung, and Carl Jung introduces us to what he calls the collective unconscious, which sort of says we're linked with an awful lot that has gone before us, and we're linked with an awful lot that will come after us. You look at what our bodies are made of, and you discover it's the same stardust that's in the farthest star in the farthest galaxy. There's a deep connection in all of life. You split an atom, and you drive the atom down to its lowest possible thing, and you find that energy and matter are the same thing. They're not separate. As I looked at life, and we spent a lot of time going to places like the Amazon rainforest and the Galapagos Islands and Kruger Park in South Africa just to study life. And life is so mysterious and so wondrous. And the unique thing about human beings is that the meaning of life, the questions about life, are raised in the self-consciousness of a person who participates in time. Human beings are the only animals that know we're going to die. I've never known a sheep to write out a last will and testament or buy life insurance. It's only human beings. Now, I think death is a wonderful thing, and let me unpack that a little bit. I think if there weren't death, life would be incredibly boring because people would postpone what they need to do today. Life wouldn't have that precious quality. So I think death has a way of ringing the bell on all of our procrastination. And if it weren't for death, there would be no passion. There'd be no reason for me to tell my wife today how deeply I love her, because I'd always have time tomorrow. But death says you might not have that chance tomorrow. You've got to live now. And my experience, both as a Christian and as a human being, is that the more deeply I live, the more I get into the passion of living itself, the more I touch that which I think is transcendent and beyond the limits of my mortality. And it's in those things that I base my hope of life after death. And that caused me, that study caused me, to have to redefine God and to redefine the person of Jesus. I don't any longer see Jesus as sort of a divine invasion from an external God into a human form. Now, to listen to some people talk about Jesus, you get the impression that Jesus is to God what Clark Kent was to Superman, you know, sort of God in disguise around
right.
the world.
A superhero.
I think the reason people believe that they confronted, met, and engaged the presence of the Holy God in the life of Jesus was that he was so completely and totally human that he became an open channel through which the meaning that is beyond the human could come into human history. And people say, well, that doesn't sound very mystical or magical. I think it sounds incredibly mystical and incredibly magical. And I think that's what we ought to be doing, ought to be about. When John's Gospel was written, the Christian church has tended to interpret John's Gospel very much as an incarnational gospel. That is, God above took over the life of Jesus, and so Jesus says things like, the Father and I are one. But I think if you read that book mystically, that is, a human life becomes so totally and fully human that whatever God is can live in and flow through that person. And so you can say, as the mystics have always said, God and I are united. God is part of who I am. I am part of who God is. That's what I think the mystery of of the figure of Jesus is, and that's what I believe the destiny of the Christian church is, and that's our vocation, to proclaim the holiness of life, not the evil of life. We have concentrated on original sin so long since Augustine, and I think we ought to get rid of original sin. I don't think it's accurate. After all, Darwin said, we weren't ever created perfect, so you can't fall into sin if you were never perfect. Mm-hmm. And so you don't need to be rescued if you haven't fallen. You are evolving. The task of the Christian church and even of the Christ figure is to help us become more deeply and fully human, more loving, more capable of giving our life away. And if we could finally get to that point, then I think Christianity has a chance to live in the next century. Without that, I think this guilt trip religion is not going to make it much longer. It's already manifesting itself in what I'd call two hysterical and empty ways. One way is to say you got to be fundamentalist and go back and capture the truth of yesterday, and by God, you've got to impose it on everybody else. And the other is the great secular society that we're giving birth to today, where people say, religion doesn't have any meaning to me at all. And so, in fact, whatever I see in it is negative, so I'd like to be rid of it. So you have blue states and red states. You have religious states and non-religious states. But what I'm trying to get is a kind of understanding of God that would not have to be hysterically defended by fundamentalists, but not be as empty as the secularist creed is today, something far more powerful and far more life-centered. Whether I'll succeed or not, you know, that's not really my business.
More information and a list of all the books he's published at johnshelbyspong.com. Bishop, it's a real pleasure to talk with you, and when you unpack things, you do so in a detailed and inspiring way, and I thank you for joining us today. I want to close with a quote from your book.
Okay.
So I now have reached the point in my journey where I, like St. Francis before me, can welcome death as my brother. I live in the appreciation that it is the presence of death that actually makes my life precious, since it calls me to live each day fully, and it is by living fully that I enter the timelessness of life. Very powerful, and thank you for sharing your very personal thoughts and this long-time fascination and interest you've had with these issues.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on your show.
Nice to talk with you. Bishop Bye. John Shelby Spong, the new book is Eternal Life, A New Vision, Beyond Religion, Beyond Theism, Beyond Heaven and Hell. Thanks for joining us today, Bishop.
Thank you.
Still to come on the Peter B. Collins Show, Gary Chu and I talk about Michael Moore's new film, Capitalism, A Love Story.
Take this pink ribbon off my eyes. I'm exposed and it's no big surprise. Don't you think I know exactly where I stand? This world is forcing me to hold your hand. Cause I'm just a girl, a little lonely.
In some parts of the world, a woman can get into a lot of trouble and even lose her life for chewing gum, laughing at a joke in the street, wearing makeup or a short skirt, choosing a boyfriend or a husband, and not accepting the husband chosen for her by her parents, or being raped by a brother. And the term is called honor killing. Rana Husseini is a journalist from the nation of Jordan, and she has been on a campaign to bring attention to and end this practice of so-called honor killing. Her new book is called Murder in the Name of Honor, the true story of one woman's heroic fight against an unbelievable crime. Rana Husseini, welcome to the Peter B. Collins Show.
Thank you.
And over the course of this interview, feel free to correct me, because one of the things that I noticed in your book is every time you refer to honor killing, you call it so-called honor killing.
Exactly.
And I think that's a very important thing that you've done. And should I slip and fail to include that, feel free to correct me, because what we're dealing with here is it's a state of mind, a frame of mind in certain parts of the world, somewhat based on Islamic culture, but it's a perversion of Islam and Sharia law. But there are many cultures who believe that a family's honor is so important, and they find only failings in women who dishonor the family. For example, a man who commits adultery is not treated the same way as a woman. Tell us why you became fascinated and determined by the cases that you reported on for your newspaper in Jordan, and what has propelled you to take on what is a very difficult case that results in a lot of resistance, opposition, and outright hostility from those who don't agree with you.
The reason I started all this is a 16-year-old girl who was murdered by her family, and her mistake was being raped by one of her brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this girl was a victim 5 or 6 times because her brother tried to kill her because she told her family about the rape, and she had to tell the family because she became pregnant. Then she underwent a secret abortion, and then she was married off to a man who was 30 years or older than her, and then 6 months later, this man divorced her.
Mm-hmm.
And the night he divorced her, they killed her, and they blamed her for the rape. And I reported this story for the Jordan Times, and the following day we received a call from an intellectual and influential woman who was screaming and yelling at my editors that they should stop me from reporting these crimes, because this is not us or our society. So I became even more enraged. And then when I started going to courts, I realized that the killers were getting away with very lenient sentences, 3 months, 6 months, 1 year. And, you know, the way the women were being killed in a brutal manner, they would empty a gun, stab them over 30 times, burn them.
Axes, stabbing
and shooting together.
Using a car to run over them.
And using a car, using a tanker. So it's really horrific, you know, the way they were being murdered. And then I went to prison once, and I discovered that women who survived these killings, or ones whose lives is under threat by their family because of issues related to honor, they put them in prison for their own safety for indefinite periods, where they cannot be released, and nobody can release them except their male relatives, and usually it's to kill them.
Mm-hmm.
So this is how it all started, and you know, I felt it was my duty as a reporter and as a woman to talk about these women who have no voice, and to document their deaths.
Well, I appreciate what you've done here, and you've gotten some attention over the years. Some of our listeners may have seen you on CNN, CNN International, and you have taken this on at great personal risk, I have to assume. You talk in a kind of offhand way in the book about emails that you've received that threaten your life, but you go into some neighborhoods where, you know, you're certainly identified as an outsider. And as attention drew to your articles in the Jordan Times, you report that people build up greater resistance and more hostility to you. How do you deal with that? And do you have a security guard or some other form of protection when you're covering these tragic incidents?
No, not really. I usually, you know, just go on my own, and I wear jeans and tennis shoes, and, you know, just to get ready to take off if something happens.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an athlete. I used to play basketball. I basically, you know, have to go on with what I'm doing because I don't think it violates any religion, any human rights values or beliefs. And I believe in faith. And, you know, if something is going to happen, it's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But so far, it's been only emails. I hope it remains this way. And, you know, it's something I believe in firmly, that it's the right thing to do, and I just follow my heart and conviction.
Mm-hmm. And, Rana, in the introduction of your book, you write, as I've mentioned, honor killing is a global phenomenon. It takes place in many more countries than most people realize. Besides Afghanistan, Bangladesh, Brazil, Ecuador, Egypt, Palestine, India, Israel, Iraq, Pakistan, Morocco, Turkey, Yemen, and Uganda, and Jordan, of course, your native land. Honor killings occur throughout Europe and here in the USA, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. What are the origins of the cultural sensitivities that, you know, leave shame on an entire family for the behavior of one person, and it's always a female? The males, as I pointed out, are not held to the same standards.
Yeah, well, there are a few reported killings of males in Jordan and Pakistan, but as you mentioned, the majority of the victims in so-called honor crimes are females. I think the origin goes back to the ancient civilizations where, you know, they used to punish adulterers in general, and sometimes they would only punish female adulterers and or have different punishments for men and women. And if we go to travel through history, we will see that, you know, in the Dark Ages in Europe, women were considered witches and adulterers were used to be scarred and so forth. So it's really not something new or something that we just realized that it's happening. It's been going on for a long time. And from my experience, it's usually happens in the poor or middle class to lower class, you know, where the word of mouth travels quickly, and some families feel that the only solution to end the talking about their female relatives, relative and her behavior is to kill her. Unfortunately, they think blood cleanses honor.
Mm-hmm.
And some families hold their daughters responsible for the honor. And the violations that a woman can, you know, could do to be killed could range from speaking to a strange man, becoming pregnant out of wedlock, being engaged in an affair, being a victim of rumor, suspicion, rape, incest, or sometimes they are killed for choosing their own husband or for financial reasons, inheritance, mm-hmm. for going missing from their house. So the you know, situations varies here.
And, Rana, at one point, I don't have it right in front of me, but in the book, I believe you cite an estimate that less than 20% of these revolve around things that actually happen, like an actual adulterous affair. A lot of times, it is simply suspicion of some action like that and not a very clear-cut violation of moral standards.
True, but I truly believe that regardless of what the woman did, she shouldn't be killed. And that's why, you know, maybe it's a bit pointed out, but I hate to highlight that.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't think anyone has the right to take anyone's life. You know, there's courts, there's justice, and if anyone violated the law, then, you know, it should be tried in courts. And no one has the right to take anyone's life, regardless of, you know, what a woman might do.
Mm-hmm. Now, before we talk more about some of the cases in Jordan and your efforts to change the laws there, could you give us a quick sketch of the government structure in Jordan? We know there's a royal family, and many Americans are familiar with Queen Noor, who has, you know, was an American before she married her husband, and she often appears on 60 Minutes and other American media outlets. But does the royal family directly control the government apparatus, or is there a true democracy in Jordan today?
Well, the way the structure is that, you know, that we have the king, and he has a lot of power in terms of dissolving the parliament and assigning the prime minister. So basically, the king, you know, is in charge. But then when there is a government, then the government is in charge in terms of running everyday life, as they say. But of course, the king has the authority to change the prime minister.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say there is a good amount of democracy in Jordan, and I think that the royal family, as you mentioned, Queen Noor and the king, Queen Rania, princess, and you know, all the royal family is sort of like the ones that I deal with in terms of like covering their news or following up on what they do.
Mm-hmm.
They really speak against this issue and violations against women and children. So in terms of their interest in this topic, it's there, but I think that, you know, the government has a responsibility, the civil society has a responsibility. It's a collective responsibility in terms of addressing issues related to violence against women and children.
Mm-hmm. But to be clear, the king cannot simply decree, for example, that Article 98, which allows leniency when a man claims a fit of fury or Article 340, which is what you first tried to amend, the king can't just decree that because he believes that these are inappropriate or wrong, that they need to be changed. It does have to go through the governmental legislative process. Is that right?
Exactly. That's why I said, the king, okay, he does appoint and dissolve, but at the end of the day, the king prefers that the system to take its course, and that such issues to be addressed by the parliament and to go through its legal procedures and the government.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the government, I'm sure the king deep down inside would like to change the law, but it has to come through legal channels as well.
Mm-hmm.
And they also depend on the civil society to play its role, and that's how we can see that there is democracy in terms of, for example, as a civil movement in Jordan, we were free. I'm talking about my experience, and that's why I do focus a bit about Jordan, because of the all the activities that we were able to do during that time, from collecting signatures, from having people sign petitions, which was something that people were not used to for a long time. And the idea that we were able to go out as groups and carry petitions and pamphlets and talk to people and convince people to sign petitions, this in itself, it was breaking certain taboos.
Mm-hmm.
And then the publicity we received in terms of our activities, our lectures, and our going out to other governorates in terms of addressing this issue and calling for changes for Article 340 and 98, this also broke another taboo, because there was a lot of debate in the newspapers and the media. People, of course, with us, people against us, people wanting to see change. All this created awareness and a change in attitude. And now we're receiving, our efforts is paying off now. There is more opposing voices to these crimes. There is more awareness among the judiciary, the forensics, the police, social workers in general. So, things are moving in the right direction, but it will take time, because these things cannot change overnight.
And, Rana, here in the United States, we deal with fundamentalists, religious extremists, and a handful of people who are not religious, but who are just extremely conservative and traditional in their views. And so I don't want to in any way sound like, as a secular liberal, that I feel that I can judge people of other cultures who have a very different background and history. But I do have to say that, as you describe, those who oppose modifications in these two critical parts of the legal system there in Jordan, that the patriarchy, the sexism, and the rationalizations come through loud and clear. Here's a quote from a member of the lower house, Mahmoud Karabsha, if I'm saying that correctly.
Yeah.
He said, "Women adulterers cause a great threat to our society because they are the main reason that such acts of adultery happen. If men do not find women with whom to commit adultery, then they will become good on their own." Now, from our perspective here in the West, this is linked to the treatment of women as a kind of property, the covering of women up to and including the burqa in some of the extreme cultures. But what he has articulated here is deeply offensive, and to me goes beyond cultural or religious sensibilities.
True. I mean, this was a quote he told me personally, and I used for the Jordan Times in an interview. And it's unfortunate, but you have people who think this way. I mean, if you all over the world, you have people with extremist views and others with liberal views. It's unfortunate that some people might think like this about women, but this is the reality. And this is where we as activists and civil society come in, trying to change this attitude and trying to really explain the true values of all religions and how they treat women and how women should be treated. Because unfortunately, as you mentioned, some individuals try to twist the religions to their likings and to their benefits, and unfortunately, it always works against women and children. So it's unfortunate, but there are people who think this way, and we have to know that they are there and try to deal with them.
And as you have tried to approach this, you have been branded as allied with sometimes unnamed, sometimes named Western forces, and they try to marginalize your call for equal rights for women and what I would consider fundamental justice with some bizarre idea that this is outside interference. And here you have a quote from the Al-Tahrir Party. Do not be fooled by the few thousands of signatures that were collected by the committee. If you really want to know what Jordanians' opinion is, just organize an opposing campaign and you will collect thousands of signatures in a few days. People in Jordan do not waste or sell their honor for the sake of a misleading campaign that is run by a few people who are fascinated by Western civilization and values. So you're a part of the corrupt Western, you know, liberal society, and that's not really the case. You are a proud nationalist who wants to reform your own country.
True. I mean, these are like accusations I've been receiving even since I started working until this day. It's unfortunate, but some people, try, as you said, to mislead or push away the focus from the main issue by throwing out these accusations or, like saying there are more important things to address, like road traffic accidents and so forth. Of course, as you said, I'm a proud nationalist. I'm a proud woman who fights for a just cause, I hope. And it's very clear that really no one applauds killing of women or taking someone's life. But it's there, and it's the easiest thing they can do to try to cast doubt on our work, on our efforts. And again, you fight this by just going on with what you're doing. I mean, I'm not going to listen to them. And it's very clear, I don't need a Western entity to come and tell me that killing a woman is not right. Mm-hmm. I have a brain, and it's unfortunate that they try to underestimate our intelligence and try to even rob us of our intelligence and logic.
Well, and it's a little heartbreaking, at least as things stand as you completed the book. Your efforts don't seem to have succeeded in amending Article 340, much less 98, which, as you point out, you think is the one that's most widely used to provide leniency to the men who commit these grisly murders. And the backlash in some ways seems to have hardened the opposition and left the government in an awkward spot because they fear that fundamentalists will demand a full Sharia law instead of the more secular, balanced approach that at least is being attempted in Jordan.
Well, I mean, this happened in the past, and it's unfortunate because the previous government was not very serious about proposing the amendments, and it misled the campaign itself, which, as you said, created a harsh opposition, stiff opposition against us. But again, you have to fight. I mean, we cannot give up, and it's part of the civil society and the grassroots movement. You have to continue the fight. You cannot give up. I mean, now there are attempts by the government to amend Article 98. They're trying to reach out to deputies. I mean, let's hope it works this time. If it doesn't work, we just have to continue the fight. And this issue is not going to be solved alone with a law. I mean, changing the laws alone is not going to end the problem.
Mm-hmm.
You have to work on many, many aspects, raising awareness, improving services for abused women, changing the laws, working on the education system, encouraging religious leaders and community leaders to speak out against these crimes. The media also, to encourage the media to continue to play a positive role. So really, it's more than one issue that's really going to hopefully end this problem.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the book, Rana Husseini, you define these two measures in Jordan's law, Article 340 and Article 98, and you also do a survey of so-called honor killings in other nations. And I just happen to have the portion of that chapter about Egypt open right here. And I want to read for people so that they understand the way the laws are written and just how imbalanced they are. This is Article 237 of the Penal Code in Egypt. Whosoever surprises his wife in the act of committing adultery and immediately kills her and the person committing adultery with her shall be punished with a prison sentence instead of the penalty set out in other articles, and I believe those are death penalties. This means a sentence of 3 to 7 years for manslaughter and heavier penalties for premeditation, but only for a man. If a woman catches her husband in the act of adultery and kills him, she would be sentenced to life with hard labor, and mitigating circumstances would not apply. And you point out, I remember the section about Lebanon, where they have a law that is similar, that uses the fit of fury language, and they also have an equal rights clause in the same constitution in clear conflict. So if we look at the bright side, it appears that things are evolving toward a status that would be at least more fair to women and could ultimately remove this concept of honor killings, so-called honor killings. At the same time, with the hardening of Islamic fundamentalism in many nations, it appears that it actually could go very far in the other direction.
Well, I mean, I hope it doesn't go this far. And I think that many NGOs in these countries are really working hard to fight these laws, to raise awareness, to defend the rights of women. I mean, like, for example, in Syria, there's been heavy work on this issue for the past 4 or 5 years. Lebanon also did a lot of work on this issue in terms of legal changes and raising awareness. Palestine, the same. You have work in Turkey, Pakistan. So there are certain countries that are really trying too hard to fight this. Even Egypt, although Egypt has other issues to handle as well. But all in all, there is work being done by NGOs and sometimes the government to try to, you know, find a solution to minimize the effects of these crimes, to change the laws. But as I said, things are not going to change overnight. It's a very hard and sensitive issue. But I think in terms of the amount where we have reached in most countries, it's very important. If you look back maybe 10 or 15 years ago, the issue was rarely debated in any country in terms of its NGOs or the press. So I think we have gone a long way. Many countries, the governments are involved, the presidents, the royal family, the leaders, even some grand muftis in Lebanon and Syria spoke against this. Religious leaders in our part of in Jordan also spoke against it. So you see there's a lot of movements towards fighting this. And of course you will find resistance and you will find conservatives and extremists who will try to fight back. But if we compare it with the past 10 years, I think it's much better, and I'm very optimistic. I'm always optimistic that things will change to the better, hopefully.
Well, you must be an optimist, and I commend you for that under these circumstances. Now, your book is filled with anecdotes, very chilling anecdotes, of these so-called honor killings. And I would like to focus on the one that occurred in the United States that you write about in Chapter 14. This is a family in St. Louis, and this goes back a few years to 1989. And one of the surprising elements here is that they were under surveillance, the family was, by our FBI, because the father was suspected of being a supporter of the PLO. In any event, their 16-year-old daughter, Palestina, who was known as Tina, met her death at the hands of both parents. Tell us this story, please.
Yeah, it was a horrific story. This young girl was in love with the man, and her family opposed. And I write in details about how one day she came home, and the father and the mother basically pinned her down and strangled her to death. And their house was monitored by the FBI, as you said. But unfortunately, at the time of the murder, no one was listening to the tape. And, you know, the case was later revealed in court that they killed her to defend their honor, of course, based to what they claim. And it was really an unfortunate case, but they got a good amount of sentence in prison. And Well, I think this was one of the few cases that was highlighted in the press at that time in the U.S. And I think now there is more awareness in terms of these crimes in the U.S. As you mentioned, there are TV stations, ABC, CNN, and many, many more, Fox even. You know, all these TV stations and newspapers also are picking up on this issue. PBS, I've been interviewed by several media outlets here in the U.S. So I think it's very important that the media cover these crimes and cover the details and the justice system that really, you know, end up in most cases, not all cases, of course, inflicting high punishments and not taking with the defendant's excuse that you know, they committed the crime for cultural reasons.
And in this case, and I guess we could try to make the same evaluation in every one of the cases that you describe in the book, but in many of these instances, Rana, it seems that the so-called honor killing argument is a pretext. You describe the two sisters killed by a brother because he wanted the entire family inheritance. And many cases where the woman who was killed had not, in fact, had an affair. And maybe she, there's one case where parents were flipped out because their daughter was communicating with men on Facebook.
True. I mean, this it's unfortunate. And, you know, the families just killed their daughters for any silly reason. And it's unfortunate, and that's why I think that it's very important that the justice system in all countries really protect, inflict a high punishment on the killers, you know. I think it's very important that this is known and reported, because I think it's unfortunate how some people just find the lives of women very cheap. And, you know, I think it's very important to raise the punishment to preserve the dignity of these women, you know, because it's unfair for someone to kill a woman and end up receiving 3 months or 6 months or maximum 1 year in prison for taking a woman's life.
And Rana, to what extent do you believe that the real challenge here is to educate women about an appropriate role for them that doesn't include being subjugated by males to the extent that we see today, and also educating men that they need to understand that, you know, women are not chattel or, you know, the equivalent of pets who can be disposed of when something that they do or believe to have done creates this sense of dishonor to a family?
Yeah, I think it's a big challenge, and I think education is the key for most of the problems we see, and, you know, improving the economic situation of these families. As it stands now, the education system is a bit filled with some stereotypical image of women. This all helps, you know, in portraying a certain image of women, and as you said, you know, some unfortunately might treat them as or kill them as if they're killing a sheep or something, you know, the way they sometimes talk about how they kill them and how they view them. So I think it's very important to empower women economically and to educate them and to push them to be able to depend a bit on themselves, you know, because I think it's really tough, and I think this is going to be a very hard thing to do, but it could happen. Mm-hmm. For example, in Jordan now there are some initiatives to work on teachers, because teachers are also a problem. You have to work on the teachers because they also carry similar values of patriarchy and of a bit of backwardness. So you have to work on them and also work on the school textbooks to be able to make some change in the future. Change is not going to be now, it's going to be in the future. And also the media needs to always play a positive role in this issue.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that stands out in your book is the way that virginity is seen as such an important value, and that a woman must be able to prove that she is a virgin on her wedding night by stained sheets or bleeding from penetration. And just last week, the LA Times published an article, Dateline Cairo, that there is now a new device or a kit called the Artificial Virginity Hymen Kit. And you describe how medical doctors who are required to examine women and give essentially a certificate of virginity have been very uncomfortable in that role because they know that that certification could lead to the death of that woman. Describe a little bit about the focus on virginity in these cultures.
Yeah, there's it's an obsession, I think. And it's not only in our part of the world. I was surprised during my research that there are people there are men in China who were seeking to marry a virgin woman. I mean, it seems like it's an obsession by some men who want to sleep with unused quote unquote women, and this is really humiliating. It's one of the worst issues that I've dealt with, and it's unfortunate that some people see women as a sex object rather than seeing them as a valuable person who's going to be a partner, who's going to be a friend, who's going to be next to them in their life, who's going to be the mother of their children. It's unfortunate that some people just value women with a piece of meat or a blood stain. Mm-hmm. On a sheet. So it's really unfortunate. But for example, in Jordan now, there's been a heavy debate about this issue in the press. It just emerged like 2 or 3 months ago. Specifically, there's these restoration operation. I did not hear about this kit. I just heard it from you, and so thanks for enlightening me.
Mm-hmm.
But there are also restoration operations whereby a woman undergoes an operation just 2 or 3 days into her marriage. And I think this is the most deceiving thing that could happen to both, because I think that men really should focus more on the values and thinking of the women they want to marry rather than wanting her to bleed. And eventually a woman can have an operation and the man can live a big deceived for the rest of his life. He doesn't know that. And it's unfortunate that this can go to this far. To this extreme of having an operation, of keeping a secret. And, this should tell you something about how sometimes the marriage structure is not correct. And that's why we see a lot of problems, including divorce, including violence, including, violence that could lead to death eventually.
Mm-hmm. And, Hannah, I don't know if you're familiar with this in the Christian world, but there is a concept known as the Madonna whore complex, that Christian men idolize a woman up to the point where she delivers their children, and then because she's no longer a virgin and doesn't measure up to the Madonna, a man feels license or permission or some sort of cultural approval to treat that woman in the range of a whore. Have you ever heard that description?
Never. First time in my life.
Okay. Well, then I won't press the point, but
yeah.
I just want you to know that there is an analogy in Christian culture, and it doesn't, to my knowledge, lead to death, but it is the same kind of judgment and vilification that is sexist in nature, because the man who took the virginity from that woman still feels superior and somehow can reclassify her as inferior because she had sex with him. It's a bizarre notion, but I'm just trying to point out that it is not something that's isolated to the Islamic or Arab cultures.
Yeah, well, it's unfortunate. Again, I agree with you. I mean, it's unfortunate that some men value women with their virtue or virginity. It's really unfortunate.
Mm-hmm. So, Rana, tell us where people can go to find out more, and in particular, if people are motivated to support your efforts, is it valuable to you, or is Western support the kind of thing that actually is used against you?
Well, sometimes it could be. It depends on how it's used. I think in general, people, need to constantly focus on violence against women in general, because I think it's a big problem all over the world. killing of women is taking place in all societies for all kinds of reasons, including the issue of so-called honor crimes. So I think it's very important to continue to highlight this issue, to fight it, to address it in a global context, you know, and then to talk about the issue of so-called honor crimes.
Mm-hmm.
Because some people, you know, get offended in our part of the world, feeling that sometimes, unfortunately, the West and maybe some Western media outlets use this kind of problem to sort of attack or demonize our part of the world and our religion.
Mm-hmm.
So if it should be addressed from a global perspective.
And I want to point out, you have a website if people would like to get more information on you and your work, Rana, R-A-N-A, Husseini.com, and Husseini, H-U-S-S-E-I-N-I. And I'll post that in the show file information at peterbcollins.com. Rana Husseini, it's a real pleasure to meet you. Thank you for the work that you're doing, and thank you for telling these stories.
Thank you very much for your interest and for highlighting this issue, and I really appreciate the fact that you care. And I think every contribution in this world will make a difference.
The book is Murder in the Name of Honor, the true story of one woman's heroic fight against an unbelievable crime. It's from One World Books, out in hardcover right now. Rana Husseini, thank you again.
Thank you.
The Peter B. Collins Show is sponsored by the Organic Wine Company. Now that you're eating organic, it's time for you to try drinking organic wines. Try the fine, earth-friendly wines imported by the Organic Wine Company since 1980. Just click on the link on the homepage at peterbcollins.com for a special introductory offer just for you. Gary Chu joins me now, the official film reviewer of the Peter B. Collins Show. And I selected Steely Dan's Royal Scam, because I think it kind of captures what Michael Moore brings us in his latest Power documentary called Capitalism, A Love Story. He reminds us of the scam that unhatched just a year ago, as Bush was on his way out the door and just one last grab for the wealth of America. And, of course, the Republicans wouldn't support him, so Nancy Pelosi stood up and helped Bush facilitate that $700 billion TARP fund. And, of course, we know much more has gone out of the taxpayers' coffers to prop up big business since then. Gary, welcome back to the show today.
Glad to be here, or rather there, or whatever, Peter B. It's good to hear your voice.
Well, nice to have you with us, however you characterize it. And I, like so many of Michael Moore's films, I came away confirming many of the beliefs and biases that I had going in. And I find his work remarkable in that he delivers this in a kind of a low-key and entertaining, amusing way. Just as we were getting ready to talk here, Gary, you had to turn down the TV on the Ed Schultz Show, and I was commenting that he's too hot for television. His populist message is very powerful, and I commend Ed Schultz. I know him, and I appreciate that he's devoted so much time and energy to the health care debate, and I commend him for that. But I have a hard time watching his TV show because he's doing so much yelling at me. And Michael Moore doesn't do that. He is a populist, but he engages you in a personal way and in a much more intimate way. Would you agree?
I agree, definitely, most assuredly. Interestingly enough, when I wrote my online review of this at the TulsaTVMemories.com and also did an audio review of it, and I sort of locked horns with another critic who writes, actually lives in San Francisco, but he writes and contributes here in Sacramento to it, Jonathan Kiefer, I think is his name.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave the Moore movie a very low rating. In fact, the popcorn box was dented in or something. I think that's the way they show their ratings when things are bad. Anyway, I emailed him, and we kind of talked back and forth, and actually we argued that he thought that Moore should be doing something better and bigger and more cinematic as he keeps going, which I don't necessarily disagree with, but Michael Moore is, as you were saying, sort of does this kind of a thing. He is a blue-collar sage from Flint, Michigan,
mm-hmm.
who now lives in Traverse City, Michigan, I understand.
Yeah.
And he just is low-key. He's a smart, kind of a blue-collar kind of guy, and he was raised by simple folks. You know, and you know, you even see his dad in the film in this one.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not going to get all even Spielberg on us, you know, with his films.
Yeah.
So I'm not expecting him to do that. I'm so glad that he's just doing the films. And some of the things that he related in this latest film, some of them just kind of blew me right out of my chair.
Yeah, I didn't know about dead peasants insurance either.
You got it, man. That is it. That's number one on my list. Dead peasants insurance.
And let's explain that, because some of our listeners may never see Michael Moore's latest documentary, but he exposes that many corporations take out insurance policies on their employees and pocket the money when the employee dies. And it's a significant part of the balance sheet of many big companies who actuarially know that, hey, some percentage of our workers are going to die this year. And instead of giving them a health insurance benefit that would help their survivors, no, we take out a policy on them. They don't even know about it. And we cash in when they croak.
And we don't give a dime to the family or the wife or the widow.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They get nothing. And then, and they usually don't even know the insurance policy was taken out on them. We can go on and on about that. You know, that's just one of the things. Also, the fact that the pilots, who had that terrible crash up in Detroit.
Sully. You're talking about the Buffalo flight.
Buffalo, yeah.
Uh-huh.
They were making less than 20 grand a year, both of them.
Yeah.
And one of them, I think, said the co-pilot, who was a female, was a part-time waitress.
Mm-hmm.
Was flying an airplane with 50 paying innocent passengers, and it dropped out of the sky because of icing, because the people weren't. You know, I'd say that sounds like a lawsuit to me or something. I'm sure there have been. But anyway, you know, those things are just really in the privatized juvenile detention center. Tell them about that one.
Yeah.
That's another one.
Well, and this is where I give high marks to Michael Moore, because in many respects, this movie, while it has some historical stuff of FDR and Reagan and the origins of greed in America, it's really pretty tightly focused on the last 12 months, and it serves as a reminder of things that have already blown past us and, you know, are not top of mind anymore, like the meltdown of the economy. And a lot of people have forgotten about Hank Paulson, who he was, and that he's a Goldman Sachs alumni, and certainly took care of his company as he was framing the bailout and deciding which companies to save and which ones to let go. But he took us to Republic Window and Glass in Chicago. And to me, that was a watershed moment where people really stood up to corporate America and to the meanness of the corporate spirit. And, you know, he reminded us of how those people really captured attention, got politicians on their side, and ultimately won their struggle. And in the same breath, I want to offer a little critique here, because one of the things that I think is a weakness of Michael Moore is that he kind of glosses over inconvenient details. And in the Republic story, it wasn't just Bank of America that was the bad guy here. They were the trigger for the shutdown of the company. But it was poorly managed, and the CEO had rewarded himself and leased fancy cars and done all kinds of things with the very money that could have gone to pay severance to those people when he shut down the plant. Yet Michael Moore paints it in pretty much black and white, that it was the evil Bank of America by itself that was cruel and shut down the plant and shut out these workers.
I think that, like I said, he's no Steven Spielberg, you know, and he's not doing a 20-minute piece for 60 Minutes or Frontline on PBS. You know, he's doing a Michael Moore movie.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to catch that kind of thing with him. I think, though, where you touched on what he is, his essence is more that he's sort of a low-key, sensitive, liberal guy who showed his sensitivity most of all in his, not Fahrenheit 9/11. Yeah, Fahrenheit 9/11. That's
mm-hmm.
the thing.
Yeah.
When he went to the visual of the plane hitting the building, screen went to black. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I was terribly impressed with the fact that he wouldn't allow people. I mean, he didn't want to put that on his screen, but he wanted to hear the sound. He sort of went radio, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Audio, and that's a good example of the kind of a guy he is. So he's going to. He's not exactly, like I say, a David Gregory or Mike Wallace or somebody that's been on TV for years and reporting, or Andrea Mitchell or somebody like that. He's just a guy from Flint, Michigan, and so we can't expect anything really, really fancy from him. But I found the movie to be very entertaining at the same time.
Well, and I think it's good for a lot of people who don't pay close attention to the news and these issues, because it really brings them back to life in a way and puts them in his context. There are some effects that he uses. There was one point where he shows Bush giving the speech about how, our economy's melting down, so we have to take your money and give it to these rich guys. And winds are howling, lightning is striking in the White House behind him, birds start to fly in. I mean, I thought that was something that really showed how you can take license and use it well.
I agree. And another thing about the movie also that something I learned in this film, other than what dead peasants insurance is, I didn't know that FDR had a second Bill of Rights that he was pushing in the last year of his life.
Yeah.
And I went to that online, and even in my written review of it, I even say Google it and read it, you know, because the second Bill of Rights box from FDR is there online to read.
Mm-hmm.
And I said that it looks like an agenda for several meetings that are going to be held next week in Washington, D.C. about some things that need to be taken care of.
Yeah.
That was 55 years ago or
right.
Something like that.
Yeah. Well, and I think that helps with the historical context, too, that we have had the fits of populism in this country where we've taken on corporate interests. We busted up the trusts at the turn of the last century, or I guess it's two centuries ago now. But in the main, money rules, and the capitalists who have that capital or who take it from us control things and really can make history suit their needs and their interests. And so I think that the other point I was going to make, Gary, a minute ago, is that Michael Moore is not a journalist, and he has never pretended to be. He is a polemicist. And so what he does is he takes a body of thought and brings it to the screen and presents it in a very compelling and persuasive way. And I think that some of his shticks are getting a little old. I believe that he should pay the security guards supporting actor roles and fees because, you know, when he went back to the General Motors building again, I didn't find that very interesting. And I think that the shtick about taking an armored car to Wall Street and asking him to give the money back didn't work. It works better in the short clip where he's holding a bag of money and asking them to fill it up. But I just thought it was trying too hard to be clever.
Yeah, I think that he's trying to he wants to obviously put himself into the film, and he's thought the ways that he finds himself in the film are as you say are he needs to find something a little bit different. And I suppose the guy I was talking about, the other critic, who said he should do something different, I think that may be what he was getting at. But I was so overwhelmed by some of the things he was saying in the film, and I was really taken by it. Another thing also, he's ahead on the agenda, too, because Sicko came out a year ago, over a year ago, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And what are we doing now? Well, we're in Sicko land right now with the health care thing. So, you see Sicko today, and having not seen it, you could say, gee whiz, what a fresh movie. It sure is the current. But it was 12 months ago that happened.
Right, yeah.
So he's kind of ahead of the pack in some ways, but I guess he needs to pull his ego out just a little bit.
And one of the things that I took some exception to is the way he singled out Senator Dodd. Chris Dodd did get a sweetheart loan from Angelo Mozillo at Countrywide. Mm-hmm. But even in the flick, they went down the list, and it showed that Chris Dodd was not the only one. And yet he was made out as the heavy here. And when it comes to banking and finance issues, I'm not Chris Dodd's biggest fan. But when he ran for president 2 years ago, he made important issues, or he made issues central to his campaign that are important to me, like the Fourth Amendment and our civil rights. And so to really caricature Chris Dodd as just a puppet of the finance industry, I think was pretty unfair.
My feeling on that, Peter V., is that he had to put something into it that had some sort of appearance of showing some fairness or balance in terms of right-wing people or neocons watching this film or something. They can't say, well, he wasn't only taking Republicans to task. He didn't jump on Chris Dodd, who's a fairly well-known liberal Democrat from the Northeast.
Yeah,
I think that might be what he was up to there. In fact, I even noticed that when it was one of his first TV appearances for this film we're talking about was on the new Jay Leno show.
Mm-hmm.
And Leno, who was not very outspoken politically, as we all know, made some sort of a remark. And I hadn't seen the movie yet when Leno said this. And he said, well, he says, this movie seems to be fairer than the ones, some of the others I've seen of yours. And it related only to the Chris Dodd part of the piece.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't mention Dodd by name or what the situation was, but I thought, well, I wonder what it is that Moore's got on the movie that will make Leno say that. And sure enough, that was it. But so I think he's trying to do it a little, as I call the fairness doctrine syndrome.
Mm-hmm. Now, Gary, what did you think of the way he used a parish priest and one of the most liberal bishops in America, a man I admire, Thomas Gumbleton, the Bishop of Detroit, to essentially say that greed is a sin and that capitalists are in a state of sin? I think it has a mixed impact because I think there are too many people who are not Catholics who have a very critical perspective or perception of the church, which has been paying out massive millions amounts of money to settle lawsuits regarding pedophilia by priests, while it appears to often fail in its central mission to help the poor.
My reaction to that was, gee whiz, we've got some pretty plain-spoken left-wing priests here saying that, and it's not so much that I completely, totally disagree with it, because I've known some pretty nasty capitalist people in my lifetime, but I thought it was a pretty heavy-handed rhetoric, and actually Moore subscribed to it subtly by saying when he grew up he wanted to be a priest.
Mm-hmm.
And he was influenced by the priesthood and the commitment they make to the common man or poor people or things like that, you know. And what kind of a religion do they call that down in Latin America, the priests or that sort, but there's a certain nomenclature.
Oh, yeah, it's the... it's the... Ooh, what do they call that? You're right.
I know it, but I can't think of it. And that's what I call it.
Liberation theology.
Liberation theology, right.
There we go.
And it's just the opposite of totally, completely authoritarian Catholicism. And some of the most conservative people I've ever met in my life have been Catholic. But at the same time, I've known some pretty liberal Catholics, too, and these guys were, I would say, a little bit over the line. And I have a sort of a mixed feeling about religious people, people who wear the cloth, being strong in politics. I know that they're coming from a set of values and beliefs that they have, but either far right or far left, when they get carried away, it always makes me a little bit uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think the guys in his movie didn't make me quite as comfortable as, say, as Father, what's his name, but Coughlin back in the old days, who was the right-wing guy.
Now, Gary, did you see the clip? I saw it online. It was Sean Hannity sans the Combs with Michael Moore. And Moore took an interesting tack with him by comparing their Catholicness. And he asked, Sean said, yeah, I was in church Sunday. It appeared to be the day or two before. And so Moore asked him what the gospel was that week, and Sean said, "I don't know." So that was interesting in a way. And then Hannity went after Michael Moore for something that I think is actually fair, maybe not balanced, but fair, which is to say, well, you're a multimillionaire populist, Mr. Moore. You've made a boatload of money from your documentaries, and I don't know what his net worth is, but it's somewhere north of $20 or $30 million.
Yeah.
And Moore really squirmed around that instead of just bluntly saying, I have done well with my movies, and here are the 10 things I do with my money. What do you do with yours, Sean?
Yeah, and Sean couldn't really live up to what Moore's been doing. You know, the screenings of Capitalism, the Love Story, free screenings have been abundant all around the country. You know, I had, there was one here, a couple here in town, other than just a regular press screening.
Mm-hmm.
And the radio station up, the community station up in Nevada City, FM station had a free screening, and actually they got to play the film for nothing, and then they did a fundraiser with it the night before it even opened.
Mm-hmm.
So Moore was doing that kind of thing, whereas I tend to think that maybe Hannity probably would be less inclined to do that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think it was a matter of how Michael handled it. I don't think he has anything to be embarrassed by. He's done well with his films, and I certainly don't quibble with that. But it is a fair question to ask that here he is, the self-appointed spokesperson for the poor in this country, and he kind of dresses that way. But you know, his bank account and his accountants would tell you, well, yeah, he's probably become a pretty wealthy man.
Well, you know, Peter B., I have met some very wealthy people in my day who are really nice people. You know, they make lots of money and they don't feel bad about it, but they pay forward, sort of, you know, or they give back or mm-hmm. things like that. And then there are people who make lots and lots of money who don't do that.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, so that's kind of where the difference is, you know, as far as I'm concerned. You kind of have to, it's just like saying that all black people are awful or all Hispanics are awful. Well, you've got to look at different people and realize that there's always good and bad in each sort of niche that you're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
That, and particularly in the area of finance, I find it's very gratifying to run into a guy who does well and is smart, intelligent, and he does the hard work, makes a lot of money, gives some people jobs and stuff like this, but he also knows that not everybody who's working for him is trying to put the screws to him.
Yeah.
That's kind of, a lot of the friends that I have who've done well through the years kind of have that general attitude. Since I've been in broadcasting, I've always sort of been in the entertainment artistic area.
Mm-hmm.
So I sort of have that more of a liberal attitude about it, where I don't think everybody's out to get me.
Well, and Michael Moore clearly has not forgotten where he came from and who his friends were. I know, for example, he came before he made any films. He moved to San Francisco at one point and was made the editor of Mother Jones magazine. And it didn't work. He hired a bunch of his buddies from Michigan who took the magazine in a kind of a blue-collar bent, and they fired him after about 6 months.
Mm-hmm. I imagine he would be a lousy manager.
I think you're right.
I think he might be a lousy manager. He can only manage himself and his film crew.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe some of those guards outside the insurance company building or whatever, AIG, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I just hope those people are union members and that they got paid well for their extra roles.
Well, I certainly hope so, too. I like the film, and I think he needs to... he will probably have something else for us in maybe a couple of years that is going to offend... ultra-conservative people a lot. But, you know, there's so much offense coming off of talk radio on the other side, as you well know, and even on Fox News Channel, that there has to be some sort of a balance of rhetoric coming from the other direction.
Mm-hmm.
But still trying to be fair in what you do. And also, to jump into another thought for a moment, I get a feeling that the Rachel Maddow at times on MSNBC really is trying to be fair about things, but she's also very biased.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't make any bones about it.
Right.
What I like about it, she said, well, do I have that right?
Yeah, but she had that guy, Rick Berman, who runs all these right-wing websites, and I've known about him because of his anti-labor work for many years. But I thought it was remarkable, and she, last week, she had him on the program, and before she turned to interview him, he was sitting at the table next to her as she went through the setup piece that was a blistering indictment of this guy. And I think it shows real balls on her part, because I've been in that situation, and it can be very awkward when somebody who you've been attacking appropriately agrees to come on and respond, and you've got to face them down. And Rick Berman is a very facile debater and a guy who can rationalize a whole lot of things. And while he presented himself fairly well, he clearly did not get the better of Rachel in that exchange.
Oh, he didn't. I thought she pretty lambasted him around, and he countered on some things fairly well. But I think she said he was going to be back on the show this week or something. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting off subject, of course. But anyway, it still plays into the idea of what Moore does, because television through the years has just not covered any of that kind of those kinds of stories, hardly at all, and you have to have somebody in cinema or in the media making films that's going to document some of this stuff, and if it won't get played on PBS or on the networks, the commercial networks, then we need to go see it at a local theater,
mm-hmm.
have the choice to go and see it or not, you know.
Yeah. Well, I think he did a good job, and you've heard my critiques of it, but I do recommend it to people. And take a friend of yours who, you know, may lean Republican, may lean pro-corporate, somebody who thinks the bailouts for the financial industry were a good idea. And I think Michael Moore can help you open their minds a little bit.
I did that exact thing. A friend I have here in Sacramento is considerably more conservative than I am. When I saw the screening coming up, I sent him an email and said, well, would you like to go see the new Michael Moore movie with me at the screening? And he went. And he said at the end of the movie, he said, well, it was entertaining. Yeah, it was. It was pretty entertaining. It was also pretty true in some things, too, and also blew me away, in particularly the dead peasant's insurance. I still can't get over that one.
Yeah, in fact, Gary, I've got $3 million on your life. I've been meaning to tell you.
Let me go slip my wrist right now.
Well, no, that might cancel the policy. Live long, just not too long, okay?
Okay, take care.
Gary Chu, thanks for joining me today. Love to hear your comments about the Michael Moore film. Shoot me an email, peter@peterbcollins.com, and pay those security guards.
Happy trails to until we meet again, happy trails.